Welcome to the Active Digital Podcast, brought to you by your co-hosts, Joe Wimble-Groves and Simon Reynolds. Joe is an author and the co-owner of Active Digital Communications. Simon is a Formula One driver performance coach and previously worked for the McLaren F1 team for over a decade. Join us to learn from elite athletes and entrepreneurs to discover why optimizing your human performance is integral to the success of every business.
In part two of this podcast with Frank Stephenson, we discuss more on Frank's car designs and how he has used nature to shape his design process. We also hear his predictions for the future of the automotive industry and shares his top tips for success.
I saw a 720S on the road the other day, and when that first came out, I wasn't sure about the lights at the front. And that's very similar to like a P1 where the back is very low, isn't it? And it just looks like there's, and I thought I was come up right next to it on the road, and I thought actually that is a really good car. Yeah. But when it first came out, it was so different, because I think when I had my McLarens, because I had a 675LT, they liked the swooshes of the McLaren logo in the lights. It was recognizable to everyone. They went, oh. Yeah. And the 720 went almost like a spaceship, I thought. And I thought, crikey, it's a spaceship.
Yeah. Well, that was again, I mean, people say, oh, it's very easy to do a headlight like you did for the 675 or the other ones there where you had that swoosh for the headlight. Well, easy in one sense, but pretty smart in the other sense, because lights can really have any design you want to make them look like. And the whole objective with lights, not only is high performance lights, but also to give them character. And what better way to give a light character than to use your logo, right? And, it worked really well. And with the 720, we didn't have to keep the logo. You don't want to keep the same eyes. You know, if you think about generations of families, typically the eyes can be one of those elements that sort of, you recognize your great grandparents through your eyes. You know, you kind of have sort of that same character, but you don't want to lock yourself into a corner like Porsche does, or some companies where it's expected that the lamp is a certain shape. So if you don't lock yourself in too early on and you try something new, you still have that freedom to go back if you want. And so with the 720, we thought, well, we want the car to look a little bit more sinister. So we're going to set the eyes deep into the socket. We're also going to put in an intake in that socket so we can cool front radiators. And basically, you're looking at it from ways, and it's kind of got that dark, sinister, almost like a skull, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so it's got the holes in there, but within the hole is the function, as well as an intake. So we're killing, you know, two birds with one stone kind of approach. It's a very technically designed headlight area through there, and distinctive.
Yeah, Frank, it was the I had a similar feeling, to be honest, as Richard did. So when it first came out, it was a bit like, wow, I'm not quite sure how I feel about it. It was kind of quite P1-esque, so obviously I love the shape of it. But as soon as somebody said to me, it reminds me of a great white, you know, kind of thing.
Shark.
I suddenly went, wow, I love it. And also the aerodynamics package of using it as to filter air through to the engine and it cools in. I think for me after that, it definitely grew on me, and I ended up loving it. Yeah. Not as much as the P1, I have to be honest, but and 75LT is definitely the same as well. I know Richard there owned that car as well.
We were getting pretty good at designing rear ends, because they were all, you know, you say the front end has to look distinctive. Well, the rear end has no less reason to be distinctive. But with those cars there, you know, they're chucking out so much heat that in a sense to the rear end design of them, the less rear end we have, the more open the rear end is, the less surface you have, the better it's going to be at getting rid of heat. So we almost, you know, we thought, let's just don't put anything there.
I'm surprised you can see so much. You know, you can see so much on that. You can see, I think it's the diffs and stuff. And you can really go, all right, okay, you can see right through. Whereas you wouldn't get that on Ferraris or anything like that.
No, they would hide it. Around. Yeah, it just meant we had to design. We got included in the design of those elements on the outside design of the differential and all those pieces, just so they would look good. But at the same time, I was even pushing to get rid of the mesh so you could even have more area to get hot air out. And the marketing guy was like, oh, we can't do that. And, you know, somebody might put their hand in there and burn it. So we went, but it would have looked even cooler just to, like, really get rid of everything and just leave a big gaping rear end in there.
I think that's what's so important is that Ferrari almost have this display cabinet of the engine bay. You know, so you sort of see through it and it's all presented lovely. But the McLaren, although the McLaren's so beautiful, It almost has a bit of rawness to it, isn't it? It's got that sleekness and the kind of that beautiful kind of princess rolling down the staircase, but at the same time, it's got that kind of raw kind of attitude to it, especially at the rear, where you can obviously, as you're saying, you can see all the way through it, and you kind of it's like a cage. It's kind of I love that.
Yeah, I get exactly what you say, Simon. It's beautifully clothed. You know, it's not like robes and extra material, but it's got a really nice clothed sort of surfacing on it. That's a little bit of design. Obviously, you want to fine tune radiuses and curves and fillets and things like that. You want to massage them a little bit and get them to be really perfect. But if you're working over top of something that looks as good as the McLaren engine does, for example, the problem with the McLaren engine, a lot of that is that the engine is so low anyways on our road cars, much lower than Ferraris do their engines and everything, simply because, you know, lowering the engine is a good thing. The mass, the CG and all that changes, but if you can pull the weight down low, makes the car a bit more stable. So we couldn't really see much of the engine when we looked through the rear. Yeah. So we had to show it from behind a little bit more. It worked out. Yeah, it's pretty good. I think it's, that shows you how beautiful or how good purposeful design can look. Done right, it can look really well.
That was one of the differences when I had, I remember I had a brilliant day once where I had the GT3 RS in the Violet with the 458 Speciale and the 675, and I wanted to just go out and see which one was the best. And I think that when you look at the design on the 458, you could always see that engine come around, you see that. But obviously on the Porsche and the McLaren, you couldn't really see any engine at all. But I took them all out for a drive and went, and the McLaren was the best car. I sold the Ferrari actually after that drive. I went and just the way the pedals the on the steering wheel when you're changing with the paddles, the feel, it felt like with the Ferrari it felt very flimsy, with the McLaren it felt mechanical, almost like you was changing gear. It's very interesting. Porsche felt fantastic because it was naturally aspirated, so it felt like you were driving more on the road, whereas the McLaren felt exceptionally fast, but it felt a bit more like a roller coaster. You're going very fast, then you were braking, whereas the Porsche you tended to be able to roll with the speed. But the Speciale did look really nice, but I think the 675 LT, the big thing for me was that rear spoiler, which you could almost wave at people when you got it right, because it almost went vertical.
Yeah, that was the way to stop the car, wasn't it?
And it was
opening the doors at the same time. Richard, what the car, I mean, obviously, if I couldn't have a P1, I'd have to look for another McLaren or something. But the one I would love to have is a 675 LT. Even if I could go one further, probably the HS. But 675 LT HS would be the ultimate, probably.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Digital, a business communications company and Apple partner that puts cutting-edge technology in your hands. Visit our website to see our latest offers or download our free customer app by searching Active Digital in the iOS App Store. Built for business, built for you.
So Frank, I recall quite distinctly our time working together indirectly at McLaren, obviously. I joined in 2006, and I remember you joining in 2008. At the time when I was there, it was the SLR, and I'd been out in that. But you had kindly invited me up to the studio, and I remember the first thing I saw when I came in the studio was this great big swordfish on the wall. I was like, that's definitely Frank. And I think you talked through with me about how you use nature and the environment to kind of help your design process.
Yeah.
And you taught me through it, and obviously why the swordfish is on the wall and about aerodynamics, etc. But do you want to give the audience a little bit of an understanding about how actually the environment has helped shape your design process?
Sure. Well, first of all, that sailfish, it was a sailfish.
Sailfish.
Atlantic sailfish. That almost got me fired because I just started at McLaren, and Ron said, just go for it, create the studio and everything. But I'd just come back from, I had to take a couple weeks. So I went down to the Caribbean and popped into Miami on the way back and bought a sailfish that had just been caught and had it stuffed in Miami and sent back to Heathrow. And I used my company credit card because I thought I'm going to use this for the studio. And it was not cheap. And as soon as the finance guy in our group saw it, he was ready to get me fired because he says, you can't go around buying fish on a company credit card. And I said, well, you don't understand. Designers need stuff like this for inspiration. And I had it scanned downstairs, digitally scanned, and the Aero guys were working on it for me. We had, it was our painter, Simon, in the paint shop, Formula
Lusty.
One.
Lusty.
Yeah, Lusty, yeah.
Lawrence Manning, yeah.
Lawrence, yeah. He did it up in the nice McLaren Formula One colors and... But we got a lot of good advice from the sailfish because, you know, it's not just a normal thing that it's the fastest fish in the sea. There are reasons why it is. And that's why it's so fascinating as something to research and understand how nature makes things be optimal for what they have to do or what they do. And the sailfish had a lot of lessons that we picked up. We used the scales, the design of the scales on the sailfish, which are very distinct. The guys at the Olympics in 2000, I can't remember when they had those suits that were patterned after shark skin. They got it all wrong. Yeah. They used the wrong
Australian fish. Team.
Yeah, they used the wrong fish. They should have gone with the sailfish. They used shark. But so that texture, we applied it onto the intake ducts on the P1. If you reach in deep enough, you'll feel this very strange surface. It's not just a smooth surface. It's actually got the exact replica of the sailfish's scales on the inside, and it actually accelerates the air in. Wow, a lot of little tricks that we would never understand because nature does it and we don't understand why, but there's a reason for it. So if you dig deep into that, you'll see it. So the reason why, I mean, I've always been fascinated with nature and biology and that kind of thing. But what the fact is, the reason why in terms of design is there's nothing really futuristic out there. You know, people think, oh, your next car looks so futuristic and all that. I don't know what they mean by futuristic. It doesn't really mean anything to me. What for me, futuristic is pure innovation. It's just finding out how to do something better than it was done before. And nature is the big teacher, the master of that, because they've had so much time, or it's had so much time to optimize us creatures, whatever, to survive, to be the best they can be. And if you use that as your pattern of thinking, every design problem has the solution already answered in nature. You can look for lightweight, you can look for strength, efficiency, all of that. Nature doesn't over-design, it sort of designs to a limit. Is all it needs. After that, it'll break, right? It's almost at that fine edge of where it's not going to break, but any further than that is not necessary. So that kind of design influence and seeing how nature has addressed any problem, be it aerodynamics or textures or materials or strength, whatever, the answer is always in nature. And it's so, it's not futuristic. Actually, the answer, like I said, the answers are all out there. All we have to do is be curious. And the problem with human beings is, as being curious animals, we start our lives as being incredibly curious. You know, all babies are asking, one of the first questions is why? And as we grow up, we lose that curiosity thing. We start taking things for granted and we stop asking why. And it becomes, in depending on your profession, less of an important factor, I guess. But in my profession, I think the better designers tend to be like kids. You know, they still have that young sort of surprise and delight emotional part where everything sort of is fascinating to them. And I spend 2 or 3 hours every morning on just researching stuff that I've never heard about. And in some way, maybe it doesn't seem like it'll apply, but the more you know, the more you can start connecting dots and they can start in turn benefiting issues or problems that you have. So if you can just keep your mind really open, sort of not close it and be uncurious, then you're going to have lots and lots of cool ideas. Most of them, like I said, do come from nature as science as well, obviously. But yeah, like I said, all the stuff that we think about that are going to happen in the future or come in the future are already out there. There is already exist. Just haven't either gone down deep enough into different levels to experiment and find out about it. But we will eventually, every, you know, we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us kind of thing. they've already brought us to a level now. All it is for us to go even deeper and find out more stuff and use it, apply it. So that's kind of the approach I use with biomimicry. We call it biomimicry when we take the inspiration from nature and apply it. You can't go wrong. Even to the extent, if you want to make something beautiful, nature does it better. Now, it's very hard to say that anything in nature is not beautiful, but the fascinating thing about nature is they apply a ratio of 1.618, which is the Fibonacci spiral, the Fibonacci combination of numbers. And if you can just use that in your proportions when you're developing a design, you come up with an extremely well-balanced design. You can't unbalance it. It will always look naturally good. And when you go against that, that's when things start to fall apart, look off balance, look out of proportion or whatever. But the closer you can come to that ratio, 1.1618, I said 1.618, 1.1618, the more natural and immediately attractive it'll look. So the answers are out there. We just got to use them and not go against it.
That explains my wife then, obviously. So
yeah, exactly. That's why I love her.
Yeah.
It was the looks.
Yeah.
Baby, let me measure your forehead to you. 1.1618.
Symmetry, everything.
Exactly.
No, I mean, there's some relationship there with my profession in performance, you know, and I obviously have been very fortunate to look after some of the most elite athletes in motor racing. And I realized that we all like to overcomplicate everything. And ultimately, you can allow the individual to kind of move and flow with their environment. And you end up actually, they benefit much better than sort of overcomplicating it, almost overusing science in some way, over monitoring and doing all these fancy things, which ultimately, at the end of the day, the simple things are the best. And just finding the balance with everything is you reach perfection, as it were. And as you said, what's already out there is out there, and everything's already beautiful. We don't have to make it seem something more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Frank, you've now got a design studio, your own design studio, which is amazing, and you've got your own YouTube channel. I know Richard has started up his fantastic YouTube channel with all his cars, and you've now got 163,000 subscribers. Which is amazing, because you only started it, I believe, like a year and a half ago or a year.
Yeah,
ago.
Yeah. So sometime during the lockdown last year,
No, it's amazing. It's gone well. My favorite episodes are the Mini Cooper, that, you know, the kind of series you did with How I Design the Mini Cooper, the P1, obviously. They're my favorites. And my favorite episode on the other episodes that you created were the Justin Bieber Rolls Royce.
Oh yeah. Controversial one. Yeah.
And I actually watched the latest one with the 7-year-old who created, I can't believe that was a 7-year-old that drew that picture.
Yeah.
He needs to be the next Frank.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. And the funniest ironic thing was, in my notes, I said that you should start selling t-shirts, and then on that video, Frank's t-shirts coming out. That's amazing. But I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about that, about your YouTube channel and your
It's probably something that I would never have thought about doing years ago or anything like that. I mean, YouTube trend has been going on for a while now, and people have jumped on the bandwagon. You know, some are good, some are bad. What I didn't want to do is just repeat another YouTube channel, because most of the car channels that you go out there, it's just basically different people telling you the same thing from their point of view, which is the car does this, it's got this amount of horsepower, you know, it costs this much, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, I know that, and I know that, and I know that. I wanted to sort of touch on a subject that is kind of hard for most people to express in words. In other words, if you look at a car, it's going to create either you're going to want it or you're not going to want it. It's just like everything in nature. You go shopping and you know, you're walking into the store and you see something. Yeah, you walk towards it, or no, you walk away from it and look at something else. Why? You know, did they get it wrong from an aesthetic point of view? Is the price off or whatever? Typically, people don't look at the price when they first look at something. It either pulls them in because they like the look of it or not. So in a way, design really sells the product if you get it right. So the objective there was to sort of bring my view of what of car design. It's a very mysterious thing, and it's a very interesting thing too, because people mostly don't understand what happens within the walls of a design studio. It is fairly secret because it has to be. You know, you don't want people knowing what you're going to bring out 3 or 4 years from now. In a way, I don't like that attitude, because I think anybody in a car company who's working for that particular car mark should feel the pride and the energy that's within the design studio, because that's where it all happens at the beginning. You know, it's that first spark and that creation phase. So that's why, Simon, why I liked, you know, when I brought you in and showed you, it's nice to see people get excited and not contaminate your feelings, but basically get that feeling that we feel into other people. And it's always nice to see that. So what happens behind those four walls is something I'm not going to come out and tell people, you know, the hang the dirty laundry or tell them secrets or things like that. But it's just nice to bring out what happens within a design studio, how we talk about surfaces, how we see surfaces, how we create them, that element of how a car goes from just being a spark in your brain, you know, just a synapse or just a neuron firing, how you bring that to a piece of paper in front of you as a sketch, because sketching in itself is a real art form, you know, communicating what you can think onto a piece of paper. Some people write books, some people take photographs, some people write songs. They're all similar in that kind of creative wiring of the brain. We basically just have to draw a shape onto a piece of paper that makes companies want to invest lots of money into building it and bringing it out and selling it to people and making their day or getting them passionate about the car. So it's a very interesting process to do. So my idea was there isn't really anybody with a lot of experience doing that on YouTube. There are young guys. But if you're young and talking about design, it's not that it's superficial, but I think you got to go through the war to be able to, you know, survive it, come out and be able to talk about it without some kind of weight, right? So you're not just talking nonsense.
The thing I love about your YouTube channel is that you put your personality into it. Should I say quirky personality, you know, kind of just out there and sort of I love this sort of 80s theme coming in there. the video games creeping in there and the whole artistic kind of poster up on the wall kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's all part of it,
Simon. It'd be very flat. I wouldn't even like doing it if I was just Yeah, if I was sitting in front of a white wall and just talking, I have to be very careful about what's in the scene, because everything in the scene is me, right? Yes. I wouldn't be there if I didn't want it to be in the scene. So if there's a piece of crumpled up paper laying on the desk, you know, well, that's not me, because, you know, I have to keep everything in the image that I can relate to. That's why it changes a little bit sometimes. And I bring in new stuff, take old stuff out. But everything that's going on is, obviously it's planned because I wanted to just have a feel to it. But that's the attention to detail that we talk about. You know, it's just knowing that whatever's there, anybody can look at it and use it as a judgment overall. But the main thing, obviously, is the message that I try to get out there about design. And I don't mind, obviously, I tell everybody at the end, let me know your comments, because I really don't mind people not having my opinion. It's nice to have that conflict. Of course, I think they're all wrong when they tell me I'm wrong, but that's just because, you know, they're not smart. But at the same time, it's good to hear opinions. And sometimes, I mean, you know, you can always say where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, if 20 people are saying one thing, then you have to give it some consideration. But at the same time, it's good to get the message out there. I really enjoy the ones where I'm able to talk a little bit about the younger generation's designs who are interested in being up and coming designers. And you can give tips and sort of little pointers that sort of take them a little bit of a level, a slightly higher level. Obviously a full on education of 4 years, you can't do that in an episode, but you can create courses. Maybe that's another way of probably giving back a little bit. So it's nice to keep the episodes varied. So you're not consistently getting one episode, just, you know, another car, another car, another car. I'm starting to pick up on the podcast too, where we can bring in very interesting creative people and getting their stories of you know, all creative people have sort of interesting backgrounds. How did they get to be that crazy? Were they born crazy? Or, you know, what happened to make them feel that way or to be there where they're at? And having them explaining it is going to be fun. So I'm developing that also. I just want to keep the guest level fairly high so that everybody who speaks is relevant. And you know, some people don't know who some of these people are, but at the same time, if they research them, they'd find out they're what we call big hitters and they have a something to say. So that's kind of interesting. So YouTube is just, I'm finding it to be, you know, people think I'm retired. It's the only thing I'm doing. Far from it. It's just, it's almost a diversion. I don't particularly like doing them because it sort of puts me in a state of anxiety of having to do the next one better than the last one. But I guess with more experience, each one makes you a little bit more relaxed, I guess, when you're doing it. And yeah, it's a challenge. It's fun. Going to keep doing them. Grow, obviously, the subscriber base, because the more people you reach, the more sense it makes to do it. And we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I love it. I think it appeals to a wider audience. And I love your little shoes you had on there. You could zoom up on your shoes and then put some quirky little noises there.
Yeah.
I thought that's
well, like, it's starting to become, it's making me realize that there's a nice part to keep it a little bit humorous. Obviously, we're talking about something serious, but I don't like being serious 100% of the time. I think you need an injection every now and then of laughter, of humor. And I think that's, you know, people take life much too seriously. We're only here for a short amount of time, you know.
Frank, do you think it's a very exciting time for design, considering that if we're going electric, then to me the design is the most important thing for manufacturers now, because you're not designing around a gearbox package, an engine package. You've got a flat floor plan. It's going to get smaller. So for me, looking at it, I'm thinking from a technology background, it's going to be fantastic inside a car. It's obviously probably going to drive you itself. It's going to have more screens. But the outside of the car, you've got almost free rein because you've got no one else going. Well, that's where the engine goes. That's where the exhaust goes, that you can really use your mind. And it should be a really exciting time.
It is for some people. I think, Richard, this might surprise you, but I think we've got the wool pulled over our eyes. I think we're all believing that the future is electric. I don't believe it.
Yeah, nor do I.
See, there we go. I'm not convinced.
Are you thinking hydrogen or?
Well, it's a stopgap. Let's call it a solution. Where if you get into it, people should understand that electric is not as clean as most people think it is. It's let's call it cleaner, but it takes a while to get cleaner because you have to go. I think it's about between, depending on the way you drive, 40,000 to 60,000 miles. In an electric car, just to offset the footprint, the carbon footprint that you would have normally with a petrol engine car. I do believe in synthetic fuels. I think that's going to be one of the directions that's going to start to really ramp up. It already is starting to ramp up. And I think with synthetic fuels, we'll be able to keep that emotional factor that we would miss. That depends on the generation. The younger generation, if they just start to get into electrics, they won't care about, you know, vibration and engines and sound, all that kind of stuff. And they'll have less attraction for something like that. But I think the appeal of a combustion engine is always going to be there, and we'll find ways to keep it going. And one of them obviously will be synthetic. I don't like the idea of biofuels. It's not the right way, but synthetic fuels are very interesting, as well as like what you said, hydrogen. I think that's, at the moment, it's quite expensive, but you know, we already have lorries, transport truck systems and things that are using hydrogen. And it's just a factor of bringing the cost down and making it more bang for the buck. That's the whole thing about energy and fuel systems is, you know, how much energy density can you get into that fuel? But electrics, I mean, the one thing for me is it is a nice, easy way to get from here to there. It's fast. Cars obviously can all do, you know, 0 to 2 seconds, and as soon as all cars do that, it's just not.
It's not relevant, is it?
It's not relevant anymore. All cars are fast because it's like a light switch on off. So, performance-wise, obviously, it's incredible. But I don't know if performance is really the ultimate thrill in a road car. I think it's more about feel and the connection that you have with the machine. Electric propulsion kind of synthesizes that a little bit too much for me, and you lose that connection that you would otherwise have. So I think it's going to definitely offer us new levels of interior design. for sure, because the packaging obviously will be different. We'll have small motors probably in each wheel or in the front and one in the back or whatever, but it will offer up new solutions for interior design. And I think that what you said is actually the future of cars right now is the interior design more than the exterior design. Exteriors change all the time. You know, you see trends coming and directions coming that change all the time. But I think we can't forget that cars have to definitely look attractive. It's almost like currently the trend in car design is ugly is the new beautiful, in the sense that how different can we look from everybody else? And you start to add creases and weird Picasso-esque type forms to cars that don't really make a lot of sense aesthetically, just to be different. And their the feel is that they're trying way too hard. And clean, beautiful design is timeless. You know, how many of us still have that love of cars from the 60s, the 50s, where they're just stunning shape? You know, you just wish that we could keep going.
I just bought a DBR1 tribute, the Aston Martin, because it's so stunning to look at. And, and I can drive that. It's got a manual gearbox. One thing we wanted to go on to was the well-being, Simon, because if we think about travel and stuff in the future, you know, we had an office and we gave up our office that was 40 staff. So we got 40 staff working from home. Our CO2 is going to massively drop anyway, because they're not traveling as much, what sort of vehicles they need. But do you feel for yourself the home working has been a big plus for you, because you've been able to do, like, you have your YouTube channel, you're at home more, so you spend more time at home, and then you travel when it's absolutely necessary? And do you think that's going to stay, or do you think when COVID actually goes away, people will go back?
Yeah, I've got mixed thoughts on that. I do love the idea of working from home, simply because on one side you can say, okay, the person's not going to work as much or as hard as he is because he's at home. He doesn't have the boss looking over his shoulder or whatever. That kind of person is not really ever going to be a good, productive worker anyways. The people that you want working for you are passionate, love what they do. They wouldn't do it for free, but they'll, you know, they'd still be doing it for fun. So if you have that kind of mentality about what you're doing, I think the fact that you can work from home is a huge one, because a lot less noise is coming into your life. You don't have that stress of getting to work on time, or, you know, arguments or stuff like that. I do think we need to balance it. In other words, right now we're at that extreme where most people don't go into the office, but you will need to basically meet up, you know, probably once a week or twice a week, not only just for the work side of it, but for the team side of it, that team building, knowing that you guys are together sort of. And so there will be a balance, but the advantages of working from home I found are quite incredible. So as soon as I left McLaren into 2017, the beginning of 2018, I started to design an aircraft, one of these new flying taxis for a German company. And I was flying there every week. So I was going there on Mondays, coming back at the end of the week, going back, you know, spend the weekend here in England, go back to Germany during the week. I did that for 18 months. I finally got to the end of the design process of the exterior and the interior. And in December 2019 and February of 2020, so a couple months later, I started the second design of another flying taxi for a US company in California, and did the same amount of work sitting here where I am right now in 10 months without traveling at all. So I still have the same amount of meetings weekly, you know, meeting with the engineers, discussing it, all the work input, reviews and everything. It was only done online. None of us were actually in an office. We were from different parts of the world, adjusted our timing, and we were able online to do the same amount of work and the same quality of work in 8 months faster than I'd done it in Germany, going every week to Germany. That for me was proof that you can do the same type of work based in a, or even better work, because you're working faster, more efficiently, happier, mentally in a better state over there. So there's something to be picked up and absolutely applied. As creative as I ever was, I mean, I didn't have that team, you know, face-to-face contact with them, but I think with the new Zoom and Skype and all that we have, it still, it works very well. So I think there's going to be a probably next year when we start getting back into traveling, I think, you know, it will pick up. We'll be seeing each other more often, but like I said, it probably won't become the norm where you go into the office every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can actually say that with the conversation we've had today about nature, about car design, about working from home, etc. I think everything has to have a balance.
Mm-hmm.
A balance of the social side is extremely important for well-being, for well-being. But at the same time, there's benefits, pros and cons to everything. And I think once we find that balance of working from home, working away from home when you can, and having face-to-face meetings as well as the sort of remote way of doing it as well, then I think we can actually see a future of where we find the balance. And I think everyone will be much happier for it. So I just wanted to end it there, Frank, and just a quick sentences to sum up. This might be, I know you're a humble gentleman. I was wondering if you could just say, you know, why do you think you are successful, and what sort of top tips have you got for somebody to aspire to maybe be a designer of some kind, or just be successful in their job? What are the key attributes really for somebody to aspire?
I think, without stretching it out too long, Simon, I think it's what you said at the beginning. You have to strive to achieve balance, because, you know, you can't run the engine at 18,000 or 12,000 RPMs. As much as you love what you do or anything like that, you're gonna over rev, you're gonna burn out, you're gonna cause some kind of damage. You have to slow down at times. And that's one of the things I've learned. Of course, during, you know, my very early days, I was running up to those high RPMs and not really achieving burnout, but once in a while, something would explode and I'd have to learn from that. But I think as I've gotten through my profession, I think what you have to realize is you can go flat out for 5 days a week or whatever it is, and you absolutely should. Because if you're not, somebody else is, yep. And they're going to achieve a higher level than you. There's always somebody out there that's better than you. So never, never, never fall in love or be satisfied with where you're at in life. You should always strive to achieve more. I certainly am. People, like I said, think I'm retired. Heck no, gosh, I'm not where I want to be yet. I still have to get a little bit better in different things. So I'm always trying to move up, you know, move myself up. So I never want to sit back and say, okay, I've gotten there. Nobody's actually ever gotten there. Jesus Christ, me, but we haven't. And I think we have to push ourselves. That's one of the things my father always, I mean, if there's three words that I remember from my father ever, he's passed away, but the three words I remember my father saying to me were push, 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 you know? And, that's just stuck with me. So it's you have to keep moving. You do have to rest. I try to really do that on the weekends. I don't achieve it as much as I'd love to, but you do have to shut the engine off. And sort of, even if it's just family life, you still might even need your time, you know, above family life too. And that's important so you can take care of the family. So, but it's balanced. It's exactly what you said, Simon. The trick is to try to achieve a point in your life where you're pretty much in a constant state of happiness. It's the ultimate state to be in, I would say, emotionally happy and content. Yet it's not easy because there's so many outside influences that do affect that. But the secret, I think, to being good is to feel happy. Never feel bad about things you've done, because it was your decision at the time, I think, you know, so you did what you thought was right at the moment. Might not in hindsight be the right thing to have done, but at the same time, you learn, and you have to constantly stay curious. I think curiosity is the one thing that keeps us young at heart, is being always trying to learn something new or open, you know, don't close yourself off to input or anything like that. And above all, nothing without good health is really important. Is your health, you know that, Simon.
Yep.
Bad health is not a good state to be in. Everything is ruined by bad health. So keep your body in shape, keep your mind in shape, keep active, eat properly. Those are the real things we have to remember. Be positive thinking all the time. I mean, it's so easy to be a negative thinker sometimes, but I always felt that anything bad that happened to me happened for a reason for me to, it's the silver lining in a cloud. Often you think it's bad, but actually it's probably a good thing that it happened to you. So a lot of us feel like we were doomed, or you know, we didn't get the right break, or we picked the wrong straw or whatever. There's always a good lesson in there somewhere. So as bad as it can feel for a couple of days, things always tend to get better normally. So
that's brilliant, Frank. And absolutely fantastic. And thank you so much for your time. And so there's some huge messages in there for people, and I'm sure they'll take away a lot from it. So thank you so much.
Pleasure. Pleasure, guys.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. And if you can, please leave us a rating and a review. You can also find Active Digital on all of your favourite social media channels and our website, activedigital.co.uk.